So tonight we want to lay the groundwork for the creed next week. And so what we want to look at basically is how did we go from 120 people in the upper room in Acts 1 to tens of millions of Christians in the 4th century. By the time of Constantine, there was probably 8 to 9 million Christians in the Roman Empire. And that's actually one of the points that Stark makes, is that when Constantine embraced Christianity, it wasn't this radical top-down imposition of some foreign religion, but in a lot of ways it was moving with the flow of how history had already been going and recognizing something that was gaining a significant stronghold in the empire. And so when Constantine, you have to imagine, you know, these 120 Christians in the upper room after Jesus has ascended, no doubt could not fathom having the emperor of Rome call a council with hundreds of bishops from around the empire, where he paid for all of their expenses to come and gather and debate theological topics so that the church could get established in the truth. Like that's such a massive sea change. And I'm very pro Constantine. I don't think Constantine ruined Christianity. I think Constantine was inevitable. And I think he's gotten a bad press. But so how do we go from this small group in Jerusalem to an empire affecting religion and eventually Christendom? Well, that's what we're going to talk about. So we're going to try and cover, 250 years in 75 minutes. This is obviously not going to be exhaustive. It's going to be highly selective, but I'm trying to pick on threads that I think will be useful for us in understanding important factors that led to that, important factors in the growth of the church, and also important factors that led to Nicaea. So if you have your Bibles, you can turn to Acts 17. I've quoted a couple verses there, but I'll begin in verse 1. So this is Paul and Silas. Now, when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus, whom I proclaim to you, is the Christ." Now, I just want to pause there. You have to recognize the Jews and the proselytes were a unique mission field for the early church. You had people who believed in God, who believed in the Bible, who believed all kinds of doctrines and had a concept of the Messiah. And here you can see Paul is explaining to them, now what you thought the Messiah was going to be wasn't quite right. He wasn't just going to be the king who came and set up a new kingdom. He had to suffer first. And here's where the Bible said that, and you missed it. That's what he's doing, okay? But this was the pattern. You go into a city where there's Jews and God-fearers, and you help them to understand what they didn't see in the Bible. That's what he's doing, okay? Sometimes they responded well, sometimes they didn't. And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks, that'd be the God-fearers, and not a few of the leading women, that's an important note. But the Jews were jealous, and you see that repeatedly. Jealousy is a massive motive for sin in the Bible. And especially with Jesus and the apostles, the Jews were often jealous of them. And taking some wicked men of the rabble, they formed a mob, set the city in an uproar, and attacked the house of Jason, seeking to bring them out to the crowd. And when they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brothers before the city authorities, saying, "These men who have turned the world upside down." Okay, so this is still very early in church history, and they're already getting a reputation for turning the world upside down. And this isn't Jerusalem, this is Thessalonica. So it's already starting to infiltrate the empire, right? "These men who have turned the world upside down have come here also, and Jason has received them, and they are all acting against the decrees of Caesar." Early Christians were often persecuted for being politically disloyal, even though they weren't, they were perceived to be. Yeah? "Acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another King, Jesus." Well, they're actually right about that. And Jesus was a threat to Caesar, just not the way that they were talking about. Okay, so the early church is turning the world upside down. How did Christianity come to have such an influence in the Roman Empire, not quite 300 years after this, at the time of Nicaea? Well, Stark talks about, He had this chart here, Christian growth projected at 40% to decade. You can see the growth in Acts there with a few verses. But his chart, this is right out of his book, he's saying in the Roman Empire, over the first 300 years or so, Christianity grew at an average of 40% per decade, or 3.42% per year. Now, depending on, you know, what your retirement account does, that might not sound like a lot. But if you look at year 40, 1,000 Christians, the percentage of the population, that'd be percent of the empire, 0.0017. Well, go 10 years, 40% goes from 1,000 to 1,400. Still a minuscule percentage. Go 5 decades. Now we're up to 7,500. 0.01, right? Go another 5 decades, 40,000. 0.07. Another 5 decades to the year 200. 217,000, 0.36%. Another 5 decades, 250, we're over 1 million now, and we're at 1.9%. That's a significant percentage of any population, especially when those people believe what they do strongly and are committed to influence those around them. Right? 2% can make a big difference. I think we've seen that in our country with the gay lobby. Very small percentage of the population committed to their message and to their agenda, and look what they've done. Okay? Go another 5 decades to the year 300. This is Constantine is actually active. He's not the emperor yet, but he's he is a Caesar. He's a sub-emperor. Over 6 million Christians, 10% of the population. So he's working with about 60 million people in the Roman Empire. One out of every 10 people is a Christian. That's significant in 3 centuries. To go to 1 out of every 10 people in the empire is a Christian. And would have been picked up on by everybody. And would have been, nobody would have had an ambivalent attitude towards that. That would have been seen as a good thing or a bad thing. And then you go another 5 decades and you're at 33 million and you've crossed the 50% barrier. Over half of the empire is Christian by the year 350. Okay? That's significant growth. And one of the things we'll talk about with population is in these, I have a chart of world population from 81 to the present, and actually beyond. And the numbers are fairly stable for the first 1,000 years because you have massive epidemics that will wipe out a quarter to a third of the population. You have lots of war, and you have a short lifespan in general. Okay, so you can see how just steady growth comes to take a pervasive place in a small group of people, relatively small. 60 million is not that big. If you think about it this way, I think Lancaster County is, what, 600,000 people? Does that sound right? If we have 500 people here on a Sunday morning, then 1 out of every 1,200 people in Lancaster County is here meeting for church. That's a significant percentage of the population. And I understand not everybody lives in Lancaster County, but most of us do. Okay, what impact does that have? And now apply that across the empire. So a few notes on Christian growth. In the early years, it was concentrated especially in the cities. So they were Keller before Keller. But one interesting thing I found, so the term for a countryman, a man of the country, was paganus in Latin. And that, and because Christianity spread in the cities and not so much in the country became known as the people who retained their belief in the polytheistic system. They were the unbelievers. And so the term pagan became associated with those people, but it had that connotation of a person from the countryside, whereas now in America you'd think of Christianity as primarily a rural phenomenon, more so than necessarily a city phenomenon. But that's where the word pagan came from. Also, there was a mix of classes in the early church. So sometimes you'll hear that the church was just, you know, the poor, the oppressed, the overlooked, and that there were plenty of those. But there's also lots of evidence, actually, of a significant number of middle class, and then a not insignificant number of upper class, including especially among the women. So to say that Christianity was just the scum of the earth, right, the dregs of society, it's not true. There's not a ton of data on it, and there's probably never going to be a ton of data on it, but what we have shows that it wasn't just the poor and oppressed. There was people in every class. Third, the Jews who were scattered throughout the empire was the primary category of Christian converts for reasons we talked about. They were primed. They were ready for the Christian message. And Jewish Christians were quite prominent until well into the 5th century. Okay, so that was a significant factor. Fourth, women were disproportionately represented in Christianity. So there were soon more women than men. And there's several reasons for that. One especially is that femininity was actually prized and protected. So the values of Rome were not the values of our day by any means. And there's a book I reference later, Glenn Scrivener, The Air We Breathe. And he talks about I disagree with a couple little things, but he's saying these values that we all hold as just, of course, this is human rights, this is what people believe, were the fruits of Christianity over centuries, infiltrating the West. And this is not what the West used to believe. And Scrivener does a good job of documenting the atrocities of the empire, especially with sexuality, but just their view of Christian life. And so the early church actually valued women, and women were not valued in the empire. It forbade abortion and infanticide, and both of those things were happening. They did abort. They would put crude surgical tools up there and cut the baby up, just like today. It's a little more surgical today, but they knew what they were doing. And infanticide, it would be very uncommon for a Roman family to have more than one daughter, kind of like the Chinese. When you have a one-child policy, do you want a boy or a girl? Well, most families wanted a boy to carry on the family name and provide. And in Rome, baby girls were not prized. And so you might have one, but if you had another girl, it was no big deal. There was a garbage heap outside of town, you just take her and you go throw her in the heap. If your baby was deficient in any way, physically, mentally, anything that would consider to be a handicap, a drain on you, take the baby, throw it in the garbage heap. Very crass towards human life. It just was not valued. But the Christians did. The Christians forbade those things. You couldn't abort your baby. You couldn't kill your baby as an infant. The Christians condemned adultery. They valued biblical sexual ethics in the biblical family. They condemned incest. They condemned polygamy and divorce. All of those things protected and valued women in ways that society did not. They cared for and protected widows. If you were a Roman widow, your life was over. Like, you were on your own. The idea that somebody would provide for you was just not, unless you were a Christian. Right? Then you had brothers and sisters in the church who would love you and care for you. And, Paul gave very explicit instructions in 1 Timothy that if she's younger, she should remarry. Right? So she can fulfill her feminine roles. But if she's older, then her family should care for her, and if her family can't, the church should. All right, so they were going to be cared for. That was not a common societal value. And what's interesting in our day is we're, in a lot of ways, we're like early Rome, but Rome was pre-Christian, and we're post-Christian. Europe especially is post-Christian. We're in this very interesting time. And so people think we can have Christian values without Christianity, and you just can't. You just can't. It doesn't work. And as they bring in Muslims and Hindus and others, you see that it doesn't work. So, and that high-status women were especially prevalent in the church, including, I think it was Diocletian who persecuted Christians. It was reported that his wife was a Christian. So if the wife of the emperor was a Christian, that would be pretty high status. So that was a factor. And then Christian fertility rates were much higher than pagans. Because again, the pagans really didn't care about family and human life. Okay, any questions on that so far? All right, a few other important notes in the first few centuries here. In the year AD 62, James, the brother of Jesus, was martyred. It was a huge loss for the Jerusalem church. James was highly, highly esteemed in Jerusalem. He was respected by everyone. And so to lose a man of that stature was a massive loss to the early church. And then 2 years later, Herod's temple is finally completed. And then 2 years after that, the Jews decide this is a good time to revolt against the empire. We're tired. We're tired of Rome. We're tired of their corruption. We're tired of how badly they govern, how they take advantage of us. We never wanted to be under anybody, but these guys are terrible. And so beginning at Caesarea, they started a revolt that led to, it's estimated, 1 million Jewish deaths over the next 8 years. So just imagine, you know, there's like a couple hundred million people in the world total, and 1 million Jews are killed in this revolt. And at one point, the leaders of the revolt, there was different factions, and it, as they came to Jerusalem, the Pharisees and Sadducees had set aside food, and they thought, you know, we're just going to grind this out. You know, they're going to siege us. We're going to have food. We're just going to, it's a war of attrition. We're going to see if we can beat them. And the zealots say, no, that's not the way to win. We have to go all in. And so they go and they burn all the food to make everybody fight. Right? And so they do fight, and they all get slaughtered. And the temple's burned, and it's destroyed, and it's looted. Right? And that's a massive judgment from God on the Jews for rejecting the Messiah. He destroys the temple, which has not been rebuilt. And so that is obviously significant in the history of the Jews. The Christians in Jerusalem, which was not an insignificant number, are also dispersed at that time, right? Because it's no longer safe to be there. And so they go out into the empire, and they just go be Christians in other places. And so much of the spread of Christianity was not these massive missions programs, these massive door-to-door evangelism programs. It was just Christians being Christians wherever they were. Right, and having babies and raising them to know and love the Lord, and then loving their neighbors. And the influence of that over the centuries was significant in the spread of Christianity. Two other factors are these two epidemics. So in 165, there was a massive epidemic during the reign of Marcus Aurelius. It actually cost Aurelius his life. And it's estimated that a quarter to a third of the population died. So again, you know, if you're working with 60 million people, you're losing 15 to 20 million people. That's devastating to a society. Like, how are they going to, you know, young girls are losing either potential husbands or husbands, right? Business owners, heads of family, government officials, farmers, like soldiers, like every area of society is massively affected. And what does that do to a society? And how did they interpret that in Rome? And then in 251, so not quite 100 years later, there's another. So 165, they think it was probably smallpox. 251, probably measles. Equally devastating. And in both of these epidemics, Stark talks about how, you know, if you're a pagan and your family member, your neighbor, whoever, gets this disease, they're smart. They don't know germ theory, but they know if they get it and I'm close to them, I'm probably going to get it. So what do? You leave. You abandon them. So you don't get it, so you can survive, because you value your life. You don't value human life in the abstract, but you value your life. And so you get out of town. Well, Christians can't do that. Christians are not going to abandon a family member. They're not even necessarily going to abandon a neighbor. And so just Christians sticking around an epidemic and doing basic care, just basic hygiene, cleaning and feeding and caring for these people, produced higher survival rates among the Christians and those they cared for. It was a powerful witness, because they're risking their life to do that, right? And so those things were very influential on just kind of the practical level of more Christians survived, and on the witness level of look at how they love one another, look at how they care for people. And there was a number of things that Christians did that demonstrated love and care. In a more kind of philosophical intellectual realm, during epidemics, the answers of the Roman pantheon were not satisfying, right? Why would the gods allow this? What have we done, you know? And they did have good answers, and the Greek philosophers didn't have good answers. But the Christians did, right? The Christians did. They could say, well, let me tell you about sin. Let me tell you about how this world is cursed and why there is death and disease and why these things. And now let me tell you about grace. And let me tell you about why this life is not the end. And I'm not ultimately living to just prolong my life as long as possible, but that I have other greater things that I'm living for. And so the answers that Christianity provided were much more compelling than what the rest of the world was providing. And so I kind of summarized here, Christianity spread through ordinary piety and just living pious lives, living holy lives, more than what we would think of as evangelism. Like, we're going to do this program. Like, great, go share with your neighbor, that's great. But I think we tend to undervalue how much just living a Christian life impacts the world. It's a profound impact in the world. Profound impact. So those are some factors in the spread of Christianity, the first 300 years. Now, I wanted to raise two ancient enemies the Christians had to deal with during this period. The first is the Pantheon. So Rome had many gods. When they were an empire, and so they would conquer lands, and when they'd come into your land, you would have your local, you know, tribal deity or whatever. And they were fine with you retaining that. They could add that in. They only required you to add emperor worship to your personal religion, because emperor worship was all about loyalty. It was the loyalty oath. If you would worship the emperor, then you were a reliable citizen. And if you wouldn't, then you couldn't be counted on. It's interesting, the Anabaptists, it's not quite the same, but that's so much of the Anabaptist persecution during the Reformation was because they were perceived to be disloyal citizens, because they didn't follow the path that society had set up to establish who could be counted on. And they wouldn't fight in a war, right? And if you can't count on them in war, what good are they? Like, that was, it's a similar, not the same, but similar idea. So Rome had two classes when it looked at religion. It had licitas, meaning licit, meaning legal, or illicitas, meaning illegal. And if you would add emperor worship to your religion and not stir up trouble in the empire, you were going to be a legal religion. There was only one religion that was legal that did not add emperor worship, and that was the Jews. And that was because the Jews had demonstrated that they would gladly die rather than worship the emperor. They were radically monotheistic. There is one God, and him only shall you serve. And so Rome eventually decided, okay, it's not worth it. You guys are legal. Keep your one God. You don't have to worship the emperor. But they didn't like it. But there was a protection for the Jews. Well, for the early church, when they come along and they're perceived to be a sect of the Jews, a subset of the Jews, well, then they're legal, because the Jews were legal. Until the Jews say, they're not with us. We don't stand with these guys. And so they start to get more and more recognized as a distinct group, and they lost that protection. They lost that legal status. And so I gave you the Edict of Milan, from Constantine in 300s. That's a green sheet. You can read it later. But that's a momentous edict, because it's the Roman Empire declaring Christianity to be licit, to be legal. So Constantine did not make Christianity the religion of the Roman Empire. He just made it a legal religion. It's legal to be a Christian now. And that's a significant document in Christian history. So, what were the Christians admired for? Well, they were admired for their care for the poor and the dead. So again, the Romans, if somebody died, it's just a body, it's just a matter, who cares? Do whatever you want with it. Christian burial of the body is it's as long as the church is long. Right? The body is created by God, and the body will be resurrected one day. And so we treat it with reverence. We treat it as something worthy of respect. And we bury it and we take care of it. And to not receive a Christian burial was a terrible thing. And so when I say they were admired for that, some people admired them. Some people thought they were nuts. Okay, we're going to see that with all these values. But over time, especially, people admired how they cared for the poor and the dead, how they treated women and slaves. They didn't destroy the distinctions between men and women or between slaves and free, but they treated them as persons created in the image of God and responsible before God and able to exercise saving faith in Jesus Christ, right? They treated them with human dignity. And again, that was not the view of the empire. Christians had practiced sexual virtue. The Roman Empire was like homosexuality was rampant and wasn't even considered that big a deal. Especially young boys, like men would have sex with young boys, no big deal. But it's just, you know, kind of whoever's around. You had a wife so you could have an heir. You could have a son who would be the heir of your estate. But anybody else, it's just sex. Like, why does it matter? Well, that obviously doesn't fly when you read the Bible. That was an admirable change. And then martyrdom. You know, the word martyr literally means witness. That Christians would have a truth worth dying for was a powerful, powerful witness. And if you read Needham, has some great stories in here. Shelley's have some great stories, actual accounts of the martyrdom of saints through the years. It's powerful because they're very clear-eyed. You know, they know what's going to happen, and they're choosing to trust Christ to the end. They could get out of it. A lot of times, it would be very, very easy to get out of it if they would just say a certain thing, do a certain thing, and they weren't willing to do it. And if you're a pagan, what do you have worth dying for? Nothing really. You know, it's everything's pragmatic. Everything's whatever you can get out of it for yourself. So to stand for something and say, I will die for this. I will not go there. I will stand here. That was admired. Tertullian of Carthage is in North Africa. It experienced some severe persecution in the 3rd century during his time as a bishop. And he wrote about how the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Right? That they were basically being planted in the ground, and from their witness, the Lord was raising up Christians. He was raising up converts. Now, there did come during some of the persecutions where some Christians were so willing to die that the bishops were saying, now look, if you rush out to die, that's not okay. Like, don't go and try and be a martyr, right? That's dumb. Don't be dumb. If you have to die, that's one thing. You shouldn't want to die. But you see that in the Puritans too. J.I. Packer talks about this, that the Puritans lived as though their bags were packed for heaven. Right? They were just ready to die. The Puritans get a bad press too. They loved life. They very lively people, but they were very ready to die. Because there's something greater than this life. So they were admired for those things. What were they attacked for? They were attacked for atheism. Because they denied all the gods, right? Except for the one God. They weren't atheists the way we think of atheists, but to the Romans, where you have all kinds of gods, if you deny that they're truly gods, you're an atheist. They were attacked for cannibalism. Because they ate somebody's body and drank his blood. Every week or every so often. Right, so they're cannibals. They were attacked for sexual license because they had these love feasts, these agape feasts, right? And that's just weird. They were attacked for incest because they called everybody brother and sister, right? And just attacked for being aloof in general because they wouldn't participate. You know, business is always tied in with religion. You know, we've seen that in our day. Even in the last 10 years, with a lot of the gay and trans stuff, where people who, I forget the guy's name, but he was one of the developers, he was one of the primary guys at Mozilla that developed Firefox, and he donated $1,000 to try and get biblical marriage enshrined in California. He lived in California. They had a proposition to defend marriage. He donated $1,000 to that effort. Somehow word got out, he was done. Lost his job, lost his reputation, lost his whole career. Because he opposed the gods of the day. Right? And if you're in a Fortune 500 company and you don't go along with whatever HR says, you're done. Right? Like the gods are always involved in religion. Well, at this day it was just a little more, we would think of it as crass, you know. The butcher was down at the temple, and the animals would be brought in for sacrifice, and then he would butcher them and serve them, right? And so you would have to participate in the sacrificial system in order to get meat that way. And Paul talks about that in Romans 14, can you eat that meat? Because it was sacrificed to idols. You know? And so that aloofness, that not going along with the values of society, Christians always have that. There's always going to be values we have. We're seeing it right now. I'm not on Instagram, and Lori always says whenever I talk about Instagram in a sermon, it's obvious I don't know what it is or how it works, which is totally fine by me. But I know that all the girl fashion influencers on Instagram are posting all these anti-ICE messages right now. Well, why are they doing that? Like, seriously, why would you do that? Well, because that's the religion of the day. This is how we stand for immigrants. This is how we show our compassion and our care. You're literally, your business is to peddle clothes, you know, to other women. Look at these jeans, look at these cute shoes, look at this. But ICE, you know, what was it 5 years ago? It was George Floyd. You know, what was it? It was COVID. It was, you know, all the celebrities singing and dancing about how you need to stay home and flatten the curve. These are the gods of the day. And it's very much tied into business. And so these are categories we need to recognize as Christians. If you work for yourself, that's one thing. But if your job is dependent on towing certain lines, if your business has an HR department, there's a pretty decent chance that you're having to tow lines that are contrary to Christianity. Not necessarily, depends on the owner's values, but even then, there's legal strictures that press certain ways. There are occupations in our society that you can't hold unless you're licensed, and you can't be licensed unless you affirm the values of, you know, the American Medical Association. Ask John Lisey about the pressure he got during COVID. The American Bar Association. Texas just removed them from certifying judges and others. They're totally beholden to leftism. Okay? So these things are not disconnected from our day. I want us to see that. The sorts of pressures that Christians have faced have always been. It's just a different face now. It's the same values. Okay? And underneath it is, are you a good person or not? Right? If you don't put the black square in your Instagram, if you don't speak out on this topic, if you don't, then you're not a good person. And the people who are especially susceptible to that are young people. There's plenty of older people too, but young people especially. So you can see how Christian values were perceived positively in some instances and negatively in others. Underneath this is this inevitable conflict, which is Christians have to affirm that Jesus is Lord. Romans had to affirm that Caesar is Lord. Okay? That was going to clash, because Caesar has to bow the knee to Jesus. So you can say Caesar is Lord if by that you mean he's the ruler of the Roman Empire. You can't say Caesar is Lord if by that you mean he is the absolute authority in all of life, and I must do whatever he says, and the values that he puts forward are the right values. No, no, no. Jesus is my Lord, and I want to submit to the rule of the governing authorities. But at the end of the day, they are God's servants who will give an account to him for how they exercise their authority. And I'm God's servant who will give an account to him for how I interact with their authority. Okay? So that was an inevitable conflict. Christianity obviously is not primarily political. But to say Jesus is Lord does have profound political implications. And that's where the Scribner book does a good job at talking about some of those values. All right, the other ancient enemy I wanted to discuss was Gnosticism. There were many varieties of Gnosticism in the first few centuries with all kinds of teachers. Marcion, I've heard it pronounced Marcion and Martian. I kind of like Martian just because it's fun, and Valentius. But Martian would be one of the arch heretics of the early church. They were very ascetic, so they were vegetarians. They didn't eat meat, and they abstained from sex. The body and sex were bad. Okay, so again, you can see how that's appealing to certain that ascetic instinct always has an appeal. Sometimes it's a large appeal, sometimes it's a small appeal, but it always appeals. In the New Testament, you see what we might call proto-Gnosticism. So Gnosticism wasn't really a thing yet in the Old Testament, but those values were starting to come, and you can see that in Colossians 2 and in 1 John. As a movement, kind of capital G, Gnosticism came at about AD 130 and went from there. Gnosticism is basically dualism. So there's good forces in the world and there's evil forces in the world. The good forces are the spirit. The bad forces are matter, physical world. And so what they believed is that there was these emanations, these spiritual emanations, and you have like the ultimate God, and then these emanations down from him, and you have them emanating until you get to who they call the demiurge, which is just a word for architect. And that's a God who's powerful enough to create the world, but dumb enough not to know that that's a bad idea. Because we don't want a physical world. We just want spirit stuff. And so that's the God of the Old Testament, the demiurge. And he created the physical world because he was powerful enough to do it, but too dumb to recognize that he shouldn't have done it. Okay, that's the God of the Old Testament. The Christ is another thing, which we'll talk about in a minute. For Gnostics, salvation, they did believe in salvation. They believed in a true way, and it came through following their teachings, of course. And it was found in escaping from the body, escaping from the physical world, escaping from space-time, anything you can touch, okay? So the problem, our problem is not sin. Our problem is ignorance. It's like every false religion, right? The problem isn't that you violated God's law. The problem is you haven't been educated. You just don't know enough. I mean, Oprah does this. PBS. Was it PBS or Oprah? They had this girl who wrote a book, The Secret. It's like the most Gnostic title I've ever heard in my life, right? It's ancient Gnosticism. So it's not sin, it's ignorance, and what you don't know is your true spiritual condition, right? You're just trapped in this physical world. So we have to uncover this spark of the divine within us. And so, because after you die, you're going to go on this voyage to the cosmos, and there's these hostile demonic planets and stars that want to crush you and keep you from getting to heaven, which is pure spiritual bliss. And the Gnostics have the key. They have the secret that will get you through to safety on the other side. Right? It'll help you in this life as you abstain from all these physical things, but it'll ultimately help you to get your way to heaven. So you can understand how when you apply that to Jesus, to the Christ, he couldn't be a man. So the first real challenge to Jesus was not that he was God. It was that he was a man. Right? People didn't have a problem with him being God because he did all these amazing things. It was that he would be a man. And so Jesus, the Christ, they were pro-Christ. They believe in a Christ. He was the greatest of the spiritual beings that they called the eons. And there's two heresies that they put forward, one or the other. One was Docetism, which comes from the Greek dokeo, which means to seem or to appear. So the Christ only appeared to be a man. He wasn't a man. He was, you know, a hologram or who knows. Or Adoptionism, which is probably more common, which that there was a man, Jesus, and the Christ descended onto the man at his baptism, but then went back up when he was arrested. So he was just there for the kind of teaching ministry career. It wasn't the birth and all that. Certainly wasn't the death. Okay. The appeal of Gnosticism is timeless. It's still going on today. And it's the secret superior knowledge. And every generation has multiple Gnostic books or Gnostic-E. So like the Prayer of Jabez. Does anybody remember that? I know I'm probably dating myself. It's fine. It's a, you know, Jabez said this prayer. But people would pray it like a mantra. Right? Oh, that you would enlarge my tents. And I don't even remember what it was. But if you just pray this prayer, that's the secret that will unlock God's blessing in your life. Right? Diet plans. This is a good time of year to talk about diet plans. Every January, I sold sporting goods and at Sears, and we made a killing in January because people wanted the secret to the physique they wanted before beach season in the summer, right? And so Take Shape for Life, that was a gospel for some people for a while, right? And this was the secret knowledge that will unlock the key to, you know, the prosperity gospel is that way. If you just have this right kind of faith, it'll unlock the key to, okay? Those things aren't strictly Gnosticism, but that appeal of, I have secret knowledge that you don't, right? I'm enlightened. I'm elite. If I'm really, really good at it, I'm a guru, right? That is so appealing to fallen man. The Da Vinci Code, I don't know if you've ever read that book or saw the movie, it's flat out Gnosticism. It's historically ignorant. It's terrible history. And he's talking about how the church voted on the Bible and voted on Jesus' divinity, and it was a close vote. And, you know, and he's talking about Nicaea. And they did take a vote, and it was 316-2, I think. And Dan Brown called that a close vote. Right? But that appeal of, oh, the church has been suppressing the divine feminine, that's Dan Brown's thing. Right, that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. Okay, those kinds of things are timelessly appealing, and part of it is a straight up appeal to pride. Right, who doesn't want to be smart? Who doesn't want to be enlightened? Part of it is a particular view of spirituality. Right. That surely there is this elitist way to be spiritual in life. From a Christian perspective, I think a lot of it shows ignorance of the gospel. I don't understand the gospel, and so I'm casting about for something to give purpose and significance to my life. Right? And lots of things can function that way. Different forms of activism, political activism, abuse activism, like all kinds of things can, this will make me an important person. Okay? But Gnosticism especially was saying Jesus taught the apostles things that they taught only to our Gnostic forebearers who have passed them down to us. And so we have this secret hidden knowledge mystery that hasn't been made publicly available. Right, because the hoi polloi, the common person, the basket of deplorables, or whatever, you know, like those people couldn't handle it. But you, now you seem like a person who knows, you know, who would pick up on the real stuff. And let me tell you about. Okay, and so it incredibly dangerous, incredibly appealing. And the church had to address it quite strongly. And if you look at the men who were called the apologists in the second century especially, they were writing against, largely against Gnosticism, against this idea that there is this elite knowledge that's not available to everyone. Okay. Now, it's not that there's nothing to that, but Christianity is superior, right? It is better, it's truth. There is truth and error, and not everybody has the truth. But Christianity is revealed truth, and it's publicly accessible. And the teachings of Christianity are not hidden in some book behind some stairwell in some monastery in a corner of Egypt that this guy visited and the monks showed him. And, you know, like, no. God has revealed himself in the world and in his word. Broadly and publicly and undeniably. Okay, so that's a pretty easy way to differentiate between, am I dealing with biblical truth or this Gnostic appeal? Is this something that is consistent with how God has revealed himself already? Right? Is this something that's out there for public consumption? And then does this truth produce fruit consistent with what the Bible describes as the fruit of the Spirit? or does it produce fruit that the Bible would describe as sin? Pride, elitism, disdain for others, ungodly suspicion, combativeness. Right? So, and another question we can ask ourselves is, are we in continuity with what Christians have always believed? Because, you know, in the charismatic circles I grew up in, everything was new wine. Oh, it's new wine. It's new wine for the new age, right? Well, just because it's new doesn't mean it's actually the true stuff. Like, new wine had a specific context in Scripture. But that was used to justify all kinds of foolishness. One of the things that you see in the Reformation is that as these men, the first generation reformers especially, did not want to break from Catholicism. And you'll see that when we get into the Creed. And when it talks about the Catholic Church, it just means the universal church. And when they, the canons of the Creed, canons of Nicaea, if we have time and we can get into them, you'll see them issuing declarations that this applies to the Catholic Church. And what they mean is every Christian in the world. Because every Christian in the world belongs to the one true church. Now, by the one true church, they don't mean the church headquartered in Rome with the Bishop of Rome as the Pope, right? But the Catholicism with the lowercase c, the Catholicism of Christianity, if you travel the world and you bump into somebody who's a Christian on the other side of the world, and they're a genuine believer, and they know the Lord, and they know the gospel, you can have a sweet fellowship with them, having never met them before. Because you have this deep commonality of having been born again and having experienced the grace of God that you wouldn't have with some other random person you met on the other side of the world. Okay? And so that we would stand in continuity with Christians through the ages is a very, very good thing. And the Reformers, because it's funny, if you deal with the Catholic apologist now, or even a Greek Orthodox apologist, if you go to the Greek Orthodox Church over by Regal, and they do their Greek food bazaar. I don't know if they still do this after COVID, but before COVID, you could go into the sanctuary, and they would give you a spiel about Orthodoxy and how it's the one true faith because it has continuity all the way back to Jesus, and right, which is what the Catholics will say too. But what the Reformers say is, no, actually, Rome, you're the new ones. And the Reformers would quote the church fathers against Rome. They would quote Augustine more than anybody and all kinds of other church fathers and say, Rome, you're the ones who have moved from true Christianity and we're recovering what the church has always believed. That's why the slogan of the Reformation was ad fontes, to the sources, to the fountains. Right? Let's go back to what instead of all these accretions that have come through centuries of the church going further and further astray, let's go back to what the church has always held to. And where Rome was teaching truth, the Reformers didn't disagree with them. They said, your doctrine of God is pretty great, and we agree. It's your gospel that we disagree with. It's your understanding of sin and grace that we disagree with. It's your understanding of the church and the idea of the Bishop of Rome. Okay? So that's an important factor too. We're not trying to be novel. We're actually trying to stand in the timeless truth that we talked about last week, the truth that once for all has been handed down to the saints. Okay. This map here is the Roman Empire at its height. So AD 117 was the farthest spread of the empire, and you can see how it goes all through what we would now call Europe. It dips into North Africa. I got to go to Morocco years ago. It was really cool going out in the desert. And as the wind blew, it blew sand off. And there's these Roman mosaics in the middle of nowhere, of ruins. You know, the building had been destroyed, but the floor was still there. Just incredibly beautiful. And so through North Africa and over to what we would call the Middle East and even up into Britain. Now, it's really hard to tell, but I did put some small white, they're more ovals than circles, on a few key places. So right here in Egypt is Alexandria. And then go a little bit to the right is Jerusalem. Go a little bit above that is Antioch. Back to the left is Ephesus. And then over in the boot is Rome. Those were the five major cities of early Christianity. And so you can see they're all, Jerusalem isn't quite on the coast, but they're all basically coast cities. Christianity was having its early impact. Now, Nicaea is up here in the modern-day Turkey, up by the Black Sea. And so we'll get to that next week. But this is when you... The map's so small, I'm sorry, but a lot of the biblical place names are in here. If you have a magnifying glass, I guess. Okay, page 11, estimated world population. I thought this was fascinating. Just trying to give us a sense of the scale of the world. Now, there's all kinds of different numbers. I use the American Museum of Natural History. Grok had a little higher number. So at 81, the Museum of Natural History started at 170 million. Grok said 170 million. Grok said 2 to 300 million. Most sources I've seen would say around 200 million people in AD 1. And then you can see it takes until the year 1000 to get to 255 million. So not a lot of growth in world population. And if you know, the U.S., depending on how many illegal immigrants you think there are, is probably around 345 million right now. Okay? So we don't reach that level until, I don't know, 1300. The number of people in our country now, there weren't that many people in the entire world shortly before Columbus. So, and then you can see how it spreads. You know, 1800, you're at a billion. 1900, 1.7 billion. 2000, 6 billion. The present, about 8.2 billion. And the projection is because the fertility rate is so abysmal in most of the world that by the year 2060, we will hit peak population. And then it will start to decline at 10.6 billion. And that is atrocious for humanity. More people is good, not bad. You know, when I was a kid in the 70s, they were predicting the ice age, not global warming. They were predicting massive starvation because we wouldn't be able to feed everybody. And world hunger has plummeted dramatically as we've had more people, because the technology has improved so much that positive for the world. As there's people die more from cold than hot. And as there's less cold, there's fewer deaths. And I'm not going to get into all that, but these are massive worldwide religious scams that are designed to produce anti-Christian values. I'll just tell you that. But just to put it in perspective, so if in 300 there were 200 million people, and shortly after that is the Council of Nicaea and the Council of Chalcedon. So a much smaller world. A couple other things. Rome did provide some key factors for the spread of Christianity. So the Pax Romana was a big deal. That they had roads and that the roads were safe was a big deal for the spread of Christianity. It's estimated that Paul traveled 10,000 miles in his missionary journeys. Now, that's not a lot for us when we drive. But when I tell my Amish neighbors that I work in Millersville, they're like, oh, that's so far. Right? It's like 9 miles. But if you have a horse and buggy, that's a long ways. Right, and Paul's walking, he's taking ships, and so for him and others to be able to travel safely, for letter carriers to take the epistles and go to a church, and then from that church to another church safely, is a big deal for the spread of Christianity. That there was shared culture, and that part of that was from Alexander the Great, the influence of Greek culture. You know that the New Testament's written in Greek is because of Alexander, that he was incredibly influential, and he's 300 years before Jesus. And so to have the shared culture where there's a language that the Bible could be written in that would be broadly accessible. That it wasn't just all these tribal languages, but that there were shared languages. Greek and Latin had significant influence on the spread of Christianity. And in a lot of ways, you can see between Alexander and the Roman Empire how the Lord was preparing the world for Jesus to come so that the message should go and spread quickly and have a significant impact in a relatively short period of time. It's God's providential preparation. Okay, persecution. It's another factor for us to consider. Most of the persecution was not empire-wide. It was local governors. But there were some empire-wide efforts. So Decius, he only ruled less than 3 years. And his persecution was right in the middle. He concluded Rome was declining. The sack of Rome, I think, is 475. So it's a couple hundred years from there. But he was trying to revive the empire. And he said, the problem is we've got too many Christians, right? And they're not loyal to Roman values. And so he said, how am I going to root them out? I know, I'll command every citizen to sacrifice to the traditional Roman gods. Well, who's that instantly going to identify? Well, the Christians and the Jews, basically. And so if you obeyed, they'd give you a certificate, you're good to go, you could present that as evidence. If you disobeyed, they were going to kill you. And so if those Christians who stayed faithful and confessed their faith in Christ all the way to the end through their death, attained the title of confessors. And you'll see that, so-and-so, the confessor. That's what it means. It means he was killed during a persecution, and he was faithful to the end. And from that, that easily gave rise to the cult of the saints and to this idea of special merit. And because that applied a couple ways. So you have these men and women, and sometimes quite young, standing faithful in Christ and being killed for their faith. Well, you have others who are like, I'm not dying for this. And so they make the sacrifice. They would bribe somebody to get the certificate. But especially for those who compromised and gave in and gave the sacrifice, they were called the fallen, the lapsed. You'll see it. Lapsi is the Latin. And that raised a huge pastoral concern for the church was, could the lapsed be restored? Because right? Jesus said, if you deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father. And the answer that they came up with was yes, with a graded system of, so depending on how bad your lapse was, right, how severe it was, how public it was, the status you held. So where this actually was a crisis was because of how they viewed the sacraments. If your bishop or your pastor denied the faith, besides the influence of that as like public leader of the church denying the faith, it was also, are the sacraments that he administered still valid? Or were those wiped out because he wasn't faithful? Okay? And so this is where they came up with the system of penance. And, some people were saying, look, these saints, these confessors who held through to the end, they have extra special merit. So can't we take their merit and apply it to the people who, yes, they failed, and that's terrible, but it balances out in the end. Can't we just, they're repenting and they're coming back. And so you can see in the early days here the beginnings of the system that becomes the Catholic system of penance and the treasury of merit. The idea, if you're not familiar with the treasury of merit, it's that the Pope has the keys to this treasury that is all the merit of the saints through the ages that he can dispense. And so that's the idea of an indulgence. An indulgence takes care of the penalty for sin. Could be your sin. It could be your dear Aunt Martha, who's in purgatory for 700 years. And, during the Reformation, Johann Tetzel came to Wittenberg, where Luther was, and he had this little ditty he'd sing, when the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. Right? Well, if you love your Aunt Martha, And she was always so kind to you and always gave you candies as a little kid when you went over. Don't you want her to get out of purgatory? So wouldn't you give your money to get Aunt Martha out of purgatory? Right? And that's kind of, and that's what made Luther really angry as a pastor, because he's like, these poor people cannot afford this. You're taking advantage of them to build these, you know, cathedrals in Rome. But all that's kind of downstream, and you can see how it develops. Like, these people who stand firm in the face of horrible persecution are remarkable and should be honored. Right? Shouldn't they? Like, they should be honored. We should esteem them. Well, should we celebrate their martyrdom every year? Well, then you have saints' days, and then you're going to have feasts on the saints' days. And well, could we pray to them? And maybe they'll intercede for us? Because, you know, praying to Jesus, he's like, that's God. Couldn't I have somebody more approachable? Right? That's why Mary, you know, praying to Mary, if you want somebody to do something, don't you just ask their mom to tell them to do it? Right? So you pray to Mary, and she tells Jesus what to do. So these ideas, you can see how they developed kind of organically. Of, well, there is extra merit here for these people, and there's a need. We've got to do something. And what they would usually do is set up as, okay, so for 3 years you have to do this, and for 7 years you have to do that, and then you can be restored. Something like that. Okay. And that's developed into this huge elaborate system now for Rome. So the Decian persecution was brutal, but it was short-lived because he died. Diocletian was, you know, 35 years later, and he was a great emperor. He was a brutal persecutor, but he was a great emperor. And again, trying to restore Roman greatness, he said, look, there's all these assassinations of emperors, because there's all these people who want the throne, and so what I'm going to do is divide it, and there's going to be two of us that I'm going to call Augusti, and then two Caesars, and one of the Caesars was Constantine. And they're the young rivals, okay? And by giving them a position, I'll influence them not to kill me, basically, is what he's doing. Well, nobody really knows why, but in the last 2 years of his reign, he decided to persecute Christians. And so he purges his army of Christians. Now, this is 20 years, just over 20 years before Nicaea. Okay? So we're right up into the time frame of what we're going to be talking about next week. He purges his entire army of Christians. He destroys churches, he burns scriptures, he prohibits Christian worship. Bishops were tortured and martyred, and many ordinary Christians were as well. Many of the bishops who go to Nicaea bear the scars of this martyrdom. Missing limbs, missing eyes. There's a very famous story where one of the bishops comes, and Constantine, who's there, and the description of Constantine is like he's a god, like in his royal robes with the sun shining through his hair and jewels everywhere, you know. And he goes up to this bishop, this poor, broken-down old man, and he kisses his empty eye socket to honor the man for his sacrifice in being faithful to Christ. Remarkable. And there's no way that the church would have envisioned that in the middle of this persecution. But 20 years later, that's what's happening. Okay, so just remarkable turn of events. And then in 305, he abdicates, which was planned. He wasn't forced. And then the other Augusti, he forced to abdicate. And then Galerius, who was in the east, and Constantine in the west, then they ascend and they become the new Augusti. Now, that brings us to Constantine. So Constantine wants to be the emperor. He wants to rule. And he's going to Italy to attack another leader who isn't, I think he might have actually been one of the new Caesars, I'm not sure. Because he wants to take Rome. And if you want to rule, you got to rule from Rome, right? And so in AD 312, he goes to the place where there's a bridge, the Bridge of Milvius. It's the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. And this is going to be for him to eventually gain control over Rome. And before the battle, he has a vision. And there's a few different descriptions. One is that it's just a cross. He looks up in the sun and sees a cross. But another is that he sees what's called a kiro. And that's just two letters of the Greek alphabet. And you've probably seen it. So the word Christ in Greek is Christos. And so kiro is just the first two letters of Christ. And they just superimpose them on each other. And that became a Christian symbol. You'll still see it today. And he sees either the cross or the kiro. And he hears en hoc signo vinces. In this sign, conquer. Okay. And there's different accounts of this too, of whether or not he painted it on the shields of his armies. But regardless, he goes and his armies triumph. And he attributes it to... Now, he had been... I didn't tell that story well. He had been praying that the true God would reveal himself to him as he prepares for battle. And he has this vision. And he wins. Right? He wins. He becomes eventually becomes the emperor. And he's attributing his success, at least in part, to the Christian God. And he's got Christians around him who are, you know, helping him to interpret these things. And so a year after this battle, he issues the Edict of Milan that you all have, which granted legal status and toleration to Christianity. So Christianity, for the first time that I'm pretty sure on that, is given empire-wide legal status. Okay? Again, not the established religion of Rome, but just legal. No longer persecuted. Okay? And the Christians are interpreting that through the lens of Isaiah 49. Kings shall be your foster fathers and queens your nursing mothers. With their faces to the ground they shall bow down to you and lick the dust of your feet. Then you will know that I am the Lord. Those who wait for me shall not be put to shame. The idea that the rulers of the church, if you haven't read James Baird's King of Kings, that little green book that we got in the bookstore, the reformers often called government officials the nursing fathers of the church. That it's the job of the government to look out for the church, to protect the church, not to establish the church. That's the church's job. Not to rule over the church, that's the church's job, but to protect the church and allow it to flourish in society, to protect it from enemies and from evil. And Constantine was fulfilling that. He was protecting the people of God, right? Because 8 years before that, they're being put to death, and the scriptures are being burned, and they're being purged from society, and worship is forbidden. And now he's saying legal. Right? Protected. And then it's just two other figures of the 4th century. It's probably four generations after Augustine is Julian the Apostate. So, Constantine, sorry. He denies Christianity, embraces Hellenism, and persecuted Christians, but his reign is very short-lived. And then in AD 380, Theodosius becomes the emperor, Theodosius the First or Theodosius the Great. And in the Edict of Thessalonica, that's in 380, he makes Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. So that's when Christianity was established as the official religion. The first nation to make Christianity their official religion was Armenia, okay, Eastern Europe, not people who put free will above God's sovereignty. That's Armenians. Armenia. Okay. And I think it is unbroken over the last 1,700 years, Christian nation. So the king was converted, and he said, "We're all Christians now," which is a remarkable thing. Okay, these next two charts are from the Shelley book, Church History in Plain Language, and I just reproduced them. I thought they might be useful to you to put some of these, if you're familiar with any of these names from church history. But you can see where Gnosticism arose in the early hundreds there. Marcion the Gnostic, Polycarp, who knew the Apostle John and was a martyr. right? Like he knew John. He's the link between the New Testament and the early church. That's pretty sweet. And then you can see the Moratorium Canon, which is the first complete list of the New Testament books. I want to be careful with that. I think let me confirm that. I know Athanasius's Easter letter had the New Testament canon. I'm going to check on Moratoria. But these are all important figures of the early church. And then the next page is the age of the Christian Roman Empire, and so that's where you can see the conversion of Constantine, the Council of Nicaea, the career of Athanasius. Now, Anthony would be a very famous desert mystic monk before monks. He was very influential in Athanasius and others. He was known as a very holy man. One of the things that happens after Constantine makes Christianity legal is people flood into the church, some for good reasons and some for bad reasons. Because if the emperor is embracing Christianity and you want to be political, guess what? I'm a Christian. And as Christianity lost its persecuted status, there were people who, well, how do we set ourselves apart now? Because if it's okay to be Christian, and lots of people are becoming Christian, but not everybody's living the Christian life, how do we demonstrate that we're committed? And that gave rise to the desert monks, the mystics, the monks and the nuns, right? Asceticism as a movement really kicked off in this time, and you know, in some ways it was a protest against the church gaining political power. In other ways it was self-salvation. Right? I'm more Christian than the rest of you because I live on top of a column and, you know, don't have any worldly goods. That's a timeless instinct too. So, there's the sack of Rome in the early 400s. Now that's the end of the Roman Empire in the West. The Roman Empire of the East, the Byzantine Empire, goes on for another 1,000 years. So, not as powerful. But Constantine builds a capital in what's now Istanbul. You know that song, Istanbul? Somebody can sing it. Exactly. He built Constantine and put his capital there, which is why Nicaea and all the other, the first four church councils were in that region of the world, because that's where the empire was centered. And so the center of power moved from Rome to the east, which is part of what led to the split between the Roman Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox, because Rome was no longer the spiritual and empire capital, right? Rome still had huge influence, but Constantinople had the political power. And then I put Acts 15 here just to give you, here's a biblical example of a church council. Why would you call a church council? Well, because you have urgent theological and pastoral matters to decide. And so you can read through it yourself, but you can see how the early church is dealing with controversy because some men come down from Judea and they're teaching the brothers, unless you're circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. So it's gospel plus circumcision. Right? If you're not circumcised, you can't be saved. What's the early church going to do with that? Well, they have to give a definitive answer. Right? Because that's a yes or no question. Do I have to be circumcised or not? Yes or no? And so that you can see how they summon the apostles and the elders, and they discuss, and they reach a decision, and then they commission men to carry their decision out to the other churches. And they rejoice that the Lord has settled the issue. And so that's the earliest church council. And everything downstream from there is dealing with similar types of things. So, all right, any questions, interactions? It's a lot of data. Does that all make sense? Help to kind of set the stage for next week. We'll talk more theology. As we'll start working through the creed, I do want to. Next week we'll start with Athanasius and Alexander and Arius, they're the three big characters, and then we'll just start working through the creed. We'll see how far we get. All right, well, let's pray.